So who are we speaking with, and what are you doing up there at Standing Rock?
So I'm a part of the Water Protector Anti-Oppression Crew, which is a group of people who've been at the camps at Standing Rock for many months. And we work in coordination with the Water Protector Legal Collective and the Freshet Collective, helping to coordinate mass defense efforts, but also working on anti-oppression education in the camps and elsewhere, and then also on broader movement defense development.
How long has the protest camp been going on, and what are some of the major events that are important to understanding the timeline of the camp?
So the camp first started at Sacred Stone last April, so it's been going on for almost a year. And that camp started initially on LaDonna Brayful Allard's land in April as a small prayer camp, and then grew from there, especially over the course of the summer, and expanded into what then became Rosebud Camp, and that all being on the reservation side of Standing Rock. And then eventually people crossed over the Cannonball River to the north side, which became the Ocheti Shakowin Camp, which is the camp that some people know has been evicted as of yesterday and today, February 22nd and 23rd. And so the camps have been going on for quite some time, and there's been a lot of different tactics, and you know, some people might characterize it as different battles that have occurred over the course of that time, with really it catching and capturing worldwide attention back in September with something that a lot of people refer to as Day of the Dogs, where water protectors were attacked by privately hired mercenaries that were hired by the Dakota Access Pipeline to provide security for the pipeline, and used attack dogs to move water protectors off of what Dakota Access Pipeline considered its land along the pipeline route. And then from September 3rd, that Day of the Dogs onward, things really escalated in intensity. And then in October, again, things really escalated in intensity, where people had established in early October a camp that was called the 1851 Treaty Camper. In camp, people oftentimes just refer to it as Frontline Camp or North Camp. And that was set up really in the direct line of the pipeline. And it sort of created a shift in not only an assertion of indigenous sovereignty over whether they wanted a pipeline built on their land, the people of Standing Rock, but also kind of brought into the mix the assertion of treaty rights as well, which is something that hasn't really been seen in the states in the last 30 or 40 years on that level of intensity. And then that camp was raided and evicted by North Dakota and then other law enforcement brought in from other states on October 27th, which, you know, people refer to as the raid of North Camp or raid of Frontline Camp. And that was a battle that became particularly heated in like a literal way. There were burning barricades. There was very physical direct confrontation with law enforcement. And there were multiple points of struggle happening at one time. And then from there, moving forward into November, there were, again, some moments that really captured like worldwide attention. So on November 20th, there was the Battle of Blackwater Bridge, which captured, again, worldwide attention from people. And many people probably have memories of Morton County sheriffs utilizing fire hoses against hundreds of water protectors in sub-freezing temperatures, which resulted in over 300 people being medically treated for hypothermia and other injuries from different munitions that law enforcement were using, tear gas, pepper spray, and then other types of like less than lethal bullets. So also on that night of November 20th was the night that Sophia Walansky was injured, presumably by a concussion grenade thrown by law enforcement, and her arm, she nearly lost her arm. And we'll continue to have medical treatment and surgeries, probably many surgeries, to regain any use of her arm. And another woman named Susie was shot in the eye and has lost vision in her eye as a result of the actions of law enforcement on that night. And then just a few days later from there, about a week or maybe 2 weeks later, there was kind of a temporary moment of celebration in the camps where there was initially a denial of the easement to Dakota Access Pipeline that was put out by the Army Corps of Engineers. And in that timeline, you know, around December, at the same time that that denial of the easement happened, that was also when we found out that a grand jury had been convened, a federal grand jury had been convened, and at least one water protector that we know of has been subpoenaed to that grand jury, Steve Martinez, and he's chosen to actively resist cooperating with the grand jury. And continues to resist cooperation with the grand jury. And so there's been quite a lot that's happened since April of last year when about 20 people started a prayer camp at Sacred Stone. And over that course of almost a year now, over 10,000 people have come and gone through the camps. So it's been a long, you know, 10 months or so.
Wait, I thought the 10,000 number was for the most people that were there at one time.
I guess that's probably accurate. Around the time of that denial of the easement in early December, there were about 9,000 people in camp at once. So probably the number of people who've come and gone through camp is higher than that. But that is the peak number of how many people were there at one time.
How has the camp changed and shifted since November? And what does it look like now in late February?
Things have changed a lot since the end of November. There were some moments of, you know, celebration amongst some when the denial of the easement came from the Army Corps. And there was also amongst actually many people at camp a sense of this is temporary and is unlikely to last, with the knowledge that Trump was about to be inaugurated and take office and that his administration had already or during the lead up to his administration, he had already been quite a proponent of extraction and has actually had been an investor in the Dakota Access Pipeline himself. And he had spoken about on his campaign trail that that he wanted to see Keystone XL Pipeline go through after that had been shut down by Obama some time back. And also he had spoken about on the campaign trail his insistence that Dakota Access Pipeline would be completed. And so even with that denial of the easement, there was a tension within the camp that this is something that wouldn't last past January 20th. And the mood in camp has shifted quite a lot. You know, the winter in North Dakota is harsh. At the beginning of December, there were a number of blizzards back to back. It's been some of the highest snowfall in the state of North Dakota that has been seen in many years. And so people have really been in camp in survival mode as much as they've been in resistance. So the ways the camp has changed is definitely the numbers grew smaller over the last few months. It's not an easy place to be. And also many people had put in long months at camp and had given up a lot in their personal lives. People left jobs, people left their homes, their families, their relatives, and their communities to come here and be not only in solidarity with the people of Standing Rock, but also, you know, saw it as connecting for a lot of Indigenous people, saw it as connecting to their own struggles in their own territories at home. So people have put quite a lot on the line, and it makes sense that people need to return to their own homelands and territories and communities because there's, you know, we say it a lot up here that the front lines are everywhere. And I think that that rings true for many people during this time. And, you know, in the sense that people have been in a survival mode at camp, people have also never really lost that willingness to continue to fight. But there have not been, in the last few months as intense of battles as there were in the months of September through November. And there have been smaller, really skirmishes with law enforcement as they started to really push the boundary and come closer and closer to the camp, especially to the big camp on the north side, which is on Army Corps land, the Ocheti Chacoin camp. And I think that also during this time, there were a lot of people who were facing harsh repression from the state. At this point, there are, you know, as of today, almost 800 people who have open cases in the state of North Dakota. There are 6 people currently facing federal felonies and looking at long prison sentences. And there's also this active grand jury that's going on as well. And so as seeing numbers grew smaller at the camps, the intense state repression really started to fully manifest in the courts.
Can you describe the current situation of repression and how has this developed over the course of the encampment?
Starting at the beginning of December, we found out about this grand jury that had been convened investigating the activities of water protectors. And as I mentioned before, there's one person, Steve Martinez, who we know has been subpoenaed and is actively resisting and refusing to cooperate with the grand jury. And so that's been going on since the beginning of December. And then with that going on, going back to October 27th again at that raid of the North Camp or Battle for Sacred Ground, a woman named Red Fonsalis was arrested and initially charged with North Dakota state charges for an attempted murder on a police officer is what they charged her with. They said that she had a firearm and that she tried to shoot a police officer during her arrest. And at first, it was just the state charges that she had. And then shortly after that, around a month later, then the feds came in with federal charges against her. And the charges against her on the federal level are felon in possession of a weapon, which carries a mandatory minimum of 2 years and up to 5 years. And she never, the state of North Dakota never dropped the state charges against her, the attempted murder charges. And they're just kind of like tabled and in limbo. If things didn't work out on the federal level, if they weren't able to get a conviction, it's very likely, and her legal representation feels strongly that the state of North Dakota would proceed with the state charges. Red Fawn had been a large part of the camps and had been a huge helper and member of the community at the camps. And so it felt like at the time back in November or October, rather, that it was a strategic act on the state's end to have that kind of chilling effect, right? If you're somebody who is integral to support of a movement, then we're going to try and incapacitate you and hopefully frighten others from filling those kinds of roles. And then a few weeks ago, I guess about a month ago now, we found out that one person was being charged with also federal charges. His name is Michael Marcus, also known as Rattler around camp. And he was charged with two federal counts, one a civil disorder count, and the second a use of fire in committing a crime. And what we found out during a very unusual release hearing where an ATF agent who is part of the ground team here in North Dakota and part of the investigatory body that the feds had put together looking into the activities of water protectors, we found out during his testimony at this release hearing that there's a pretty massive federal investigation into the activities of water protectors. And they seem fairly focused on the happenings on and around October 27th that involved burning barricades. And that's what they allege that Michael Marcus was a part of. Then about a week or two later, a previously sealed indictment became unsealed, and we found out that Michael Marcus has four co-defendants that the state alleges were in a conspiracy of sorts together to use fire in committing a crime, specifically that fire was used to impede the movements and actions of law enforcement on that day in their efforts to raid the North Camp. And so shortly after that, it was also made public that the Joint Terrorism Task Force is on the ground here in North Dakota as well, looking into the activities of water protectors. And so some of our suspicions from the anti-repression crew over the last few months were exactly this, that, you know, the state of North Dakota is, you know, racking up charges, mostly misdemeanors, although there are some felonies that people are facing, most of which carry a maximum, the felonies on the state level carry a maximum of 5 years in prison. But we assumed that there was also a larger federal schematic being put together in the background. And we found out through Agent Hill from the ATF testimony that that was indeed the case. And then they continue to be present. Today and yesterday, there was an eviction of Ocheti Shakoin Camp that had been announced for several weeks by the Army Corps when they approved the easement, ultimately, at the urging of the Trump administration. We've also noticed that ATF and FBI were on the scene of the eviction as well, as well as many other law enforcement agencies that were present, including Homeland Security. Today, they had a Border Patrol helicopter doing surveillance over the camps. So there's quite a massing of federal forces here in North Dakota at Standing Rock that seem not only to have the purpose of shutting down this camp, but also it seems to be very intentional that this is not the only pipeline that is being built or is proposed to be built. There are many other pipelines that will be going through many people's territories across North America and across the U.S. And this is a moment where I think, and we believe that the Trump administration and federal government want to make a strong statement of zero tolerance around indigenous sovereignty and earth defense.
What has been going on the past couple of days with the eviction of the Ocheti Shakoin camp?
So a few weeks ago, when the Army Corps ultimately approved the easement for Dakota Access Pipeline to drill underneath the Missouri River at the Lake Oahe point, they gave a deadline of February 23rd. And then they actually ended up coming in with a fairly large amassing of law enforcement yesterday on February 22nd. And there were about 10 arrests yesterday at the camp. Primarily the people who were arrested yesterday were independent journalists, legal observers, and I think one water protector, someone who, you know, wasn't fulfilling like a support or media role. But yesterday they seemed to really be targeting media in a pretty overt way. And then today, they came in around 9 a.m. into the big camp, to Ocheti Shakoin, and they came in a much more militarized fashion into the camp. Most people had left Ocheti yesterday, though there were a few people who had chosen to remain. There were about 20 people at the Cheyenne River camp within Ocheti who had made very clear yesterday and very publicly stated that they would passively resist the eviction. Many of the people at the Cheyenne River camp are Ogallala Lakota and come from the Pine Ridge area. And Pine Ridge has a long history of struggle against the state. And they also have quite a stake in seeing this pipeline stopped. They are reliant on the water from the Ogallala Aquifer, which is fed by the Missouri River, and is actually Pine Ridge's last opportunity for clean water, as the remaining portion of their water is already contaminated by uranium mining. And so not only do people feel very strongly from Pine Ridge that their water is in danger, but also feel very strongly about asserting their treaty rights. And so that was a big part of their choice in resisting passively the eviction yesterday, was to assert their treaty rights. The land that the Army Corps claims as theirs in that area is unceded treaty land that was never ceded to the federal government nor the state of North Dakota, and still belongs to the Great Sioux Nation according to the Treaty of Fort Laramie of 1868. And then there were also, you know, around 70 other people who remained in Ocheti as of this morning, many of whom, as law enforcement moved in, chose to move south across the Cannonball River, which is currently frozen. So people were walking across the frozen river to the reservation side, assuming that if they went onto the reservation side, that it would be a safe place, as there had been no eviction notice given to the camp on the other side of the river at Rosebud, where people were fleeing to. But then in the afternoon, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, or BIA, entered into Rosebud Camp and also started arresting people on the Rosebud Reservation side as well. And so there seems to be an attempt at evicting the Rosebud encampment. And there had been an attempt to, in a very like sneaky, shady way, evict Sacred Stone Camp as well. But Sacred Stone is on land that is privately owned by LaDonna Braithwaite Allard and her family. And there seems to be a strong collusion between tribal governance at Standing Rock and federal law enforcement and the Trump administration to push out Sacred Stone Camp as well. A few weeks ago, Sacred Stone was served an eviction notice, and the tribe asserted that they owned 66% of LaDonna's land, which is untrue. And LaDonna, with the help of a legal team, was able to call off that eviction and resist that eviction. But we all assume here on the ground that they will continue to try and find ways to push people off of LaDonna's land at Sacred Stone as well.
Can you speak to the different elements of leadership within the camp and how that may or may not intersect with collusion with the state?
I think any time that you get a mass movement together, in my personal experience and in my knowledge of history, is that there are many forces at play, and there is no such thing on the ground as unity. And I think that that rings true for the struggle at Standing Rock as well. You know, with as many as thousands of people have come to and from this camp, there are people who come for many different reasons. There are definitely your NGOs and your movement manager types that have come to and from camp. But I think the thing that sticks out the most as far as where some like dark kind of collusion with the state or with capital exists is in tribal governance in this situation in particular. And if people know the history of tribal governments and how they were set up, these are not the ways in which indigenous communities historically, traditionally govern themselves. This is a colonial model of governance that has been imposed upon indigenous people in North America, in the U.S. And so as much as people want to say that they're here at the camps in solidarity with Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, that becomes very blurry. And on the ground over the months that this camp, these camps have existed, it has become blurry over and over again, including for myself. There was a time back in early December when the Army Corps denied the easement that Dave Archambault, the tribal chairman of Standing Rock, came to the camp to announce this and then drove around in his pickup truck around camp telling everyone it was time to go home. And the tribe has repeatedly, the tribal government has repeatedly insisted that people need to go home, that this battle is in the courtrooms now, and that the need for the camp is, or the camps is over. That's not how people at the camps feel. And while they wish to be in solidarity with Standing Rock Sioux Reservation and the people of Standing Rock, it becomes about being in solidarity with the people and the land and the water, as opposed to being in solidarity with a tribal government. And the history of tribal governments across the U.S. is that they often are in collusion with the federal government and their wishes, or with the wishes of capital. Over and over again on many reservations, you see tribal governments sell out their own people and act against the interests or wishes of the people on the res. And so this is not an unusual turn of events when it comes to struggles for Indigenous sovereignty over their lands and waters, but it's heartbreaking for people to watch. There's also been moments where just individual people's desires for how struggle is enacted on a front line come to a head, where, you know, some people have one view of a tactic that might be useful and others have a different view. Many people are familiar with the assertion that this is a prayerful movement. And I think for a lot of people who don't come from Indigenous spiritual practice have a hard time understanding what people here at the camps mean when they say that this is a prayerful movement. For Indigenous people, the way it has been explained to me, I'm not Native, but the way that I've heard many people talk about it who are Native is that prayer for them is not something that you do at church, in the way that a lot of like Christians view prayer is something that you do, and then you like brush your teeth and you move on with your day. For Indigenous people, prayer is something that you enact. And so to set up a prayer camp in resistance to a pipeline, your prayers are your resistance. And it's your words and your ceremony as much as it's your actions on the front line. And I think that that's important for people to take into consideration in this situation. The differences between Indigenous practices and the practices of tribal government, or individuals' choices on a front line and the choices of an NGO that has grants to uphold and that they hope will be renewed in the future.
While you've been up there, have you seen any shifts in participants' views on tactics as a result of their time being at the camps?
I definitely have seen how not just individuals' views about tactics have shifted and changed over their time in camp, but I've also seen how organizations' tactics have changed with their time in camp. An organization called IP3, Indigenous Peoples Power Project, came to the camps back in, I believe, September or October. And they're a nonprofit organization. It's an Indigenous organization that provides all types of training, but they do a lot of direct action training, know your rights training across the U.S. in a lot of different territories. And initially, when they came to camp, there was a very strong dynamic within the camp of elder leadership, and that being very central in Indigenous struggles traditionally. But the way that that played out in the camp became very confusing for many people. You know, an action would be occurring, people would be on a front line, there would be tear gas flying, and all of a sudden someone would run up and say, the elders say that everybody needs to go home, return to the camp. But it was very unclear, who are these elders, and where are they to tell us this? And why have they sent this person who is clearly not an elder, and has this person ever spoken to an elder? So it became really confusing on front lines many times over especially October through November, of this dynamic of, you know, the front line, things are heated, people are battling with the police, and then the elders have called everybody back. And what I watched with IP3 was a shift from automatically telling their folks to come back anytime that some random person ran up and said the elders say go home, to then starting to train their people in direct action trainings, which they were running every single day at camp for months, telling people that when you go out to an action, whether it be an action near the pipeline or an action in town in Mandan or Bismarck, the two big towns about an hour north of where the camps are, that you go out with an objective and you stick to the objective no matter what. And then on Thanksgiving Day or Thanksgiving, there was a action at a place called Turtle Island, which is a sacred spot for the people of Standing Rock that's just on the northeast side of the Ocheti camp. And there's a creek called the Kenetapa Creek that is like a water barrier between where the camp is and where Turtle Island is. And law enforcement had taken over Turtle Island, which to the people of Standing Rock and to Indigenous people who are at the camp was very offensive to watch law enforcement desecrating this sacred place. And so there had been many attempts previously in the weeks prior to retake Turtle Island, people building bridges or running boats across. And then on Thanksgiving Day, IP3 helped to organize an action where they successfully built a bridge and got hundreds of people across onto Turtle Island for prayer and ceremony. And then that same thing played out again, where suddenly people come from nowhere saying, the elders have called everybody back. We need to go home. This shouldn't happen. It's not sanctioned by the elders. And I watched, you know, people from IP3 tell the people who had come for this action, stay here and finish what you're here to do. We're here for prayer and for ceremony, and we'll complete our prayers and our ceremony before we go home. We go home when our action is done. And so even some of these more, you know, people we might consider more liberal entities, I did see their shift and their change. One of the most dramatic shifts on that front, though, was when Red Warrior Camp established itself at Standing Rock. And along with Red Warrior came a much more like direct action approach. It's where a lot of, you know, back in September, October, early November, a lot of direct actions came through Red Warrior. And while some of the more like liberal movement manager types worked very hard through a gossip campaign to malign Red Warrior within the camps at Standing Rock, it also helped to embolden people from other camps to really step up the kinds of actions that they were willing to take. And many people, you know, have a lot to say about Red Warrior that, you know, they're wild, they are not prayerful, they have no elder leadership, and none of those things are true. All of their actions were done with, you know, intention and ceremony and prayer, but they really view their prayers as action. And in speaking with people from Red Warrior Camp, that was clear over and over again, that they had their own elders, and they knew who their elders are. You know, they're very aware and in relationship with their elders, as traditionally it should be. And that kind of model, I think, shifted for a lot of people coming through the camps, what that could look like, what traditional leadership from your elders can look like, but it also needs to really be traditional. It needs to be people you're in relationship with. And then that started to be sort of modeled in other encampments and groups of people within the larger camp framework. You know, when people talk about like the camps at Standing Rock, there's actually like a whole lot of camps. As much as there is Red Warrior Camp, there were like 20 other crews of people that came with like their tribe or their community and set up their own camp within the camp and really had their own structure within it. and were making decisions within their own smaller encampment, had their own grandmothers and their own elders that they were getting leadership and wisdom from. Yeah.
Finally, what are some of your most cherished memories from Standing Rock and the No Dakota Access Pipeline Resistance?
I'm actually really glad that you asked this, especially at a time that, you know, today and yesterday have been pretty dark days for people up here with the eviction of Oshetti Shakowin. And, you know, the visions in our minds from the last 2 days are burning structures that many of us have spent time building, and many of us spent time in those structures, or our, you know, comrades or loved ones or relatives, those were their homes for many months. And so I think it's a good time to remember some of the really beautiful things that have occurred at camp. You know, when I first came to camp, I was spending the majority of my time at Red Warrior Camp, and living there amongst friends and comrades, some old and some new. And there were a lot of times where it was just a mess of children running around camp while grown-ups are scurrying around and doing the work of the day and chopping wood and cooking food. Some of my favorite memories are that, where I'd watch, you know, people who are very busy, you know, elders and people who are planning stopping a, you know, multi-billion dollar pipeline, also take time out of their day to play with little ones who are begging for their attention. And so there's a lot of really beautiful moments at camp. And one thing that I remember someone saying on that note is Alas from Savage Fam, who spent many months at Red Warrior. I remember her saying one night at a concert, like, we're not supposed to live this way. We're supposed to be at home in our own territories, building up our own people. But we're here and we're fighting. And as much as we're not supposed to live this way, where we're not supposed to be living in constant struggle and battle, there's something really beautiful about the camps where in some ways, maybe we are supposed to live this way. Not so much living under the sniper scopes and floodlights of Dakota Access Pipeline, but living in real community with one another, where there's plenty of work to do, but no one is leaving their children at home to go to a job. Their children are alongside of them while they're doing the work of their day. And those moments at camp, I think, are things that a lot of people will carry with them. I've also seen some incredibly powerful moments of ceremony and prayer, where back in December, there was a women's march up to where Morton County Sheriff had barricaded off Highway 1806 on the north end of camp. And that barricade still remains there. It's been there for many months. But when this women's march happened, there was a group of elders, grandmothers at the front, and it was hundreds of women behind them, totally silent. And just all you could hear in, you know, from the back all the way to the front of the barricade, where these grandmothers are facing down snipers and, you know, a militarized barricade, you could hear their prayers and their ceremony. And it was one of the most beautiful and impactful things I've ever seen. And I'm, you know, I come from a very different spiritual tradition and practice. But it's maybe the most impactful spiritual practice I've ever seen in that moment, those particular grandmothers on that front line. And I hope that as much as it's been a dark time these last couple of days with the eviction happening and 45 people sitting in jail tonight, I hope that people will hold on to all those things that they experienced at camp and that they've returned to their homes and their territories with, and will carry some of those ways that we kind of all discovered together. Maybe we are meant to live a little bit like this.